I've written a column for the latest issues, etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
It's an instinct. Feeling. The force brought us together. We're not alone. Good people will fight if we lead them.
People keep telling me they know me. No one does.
But I do.
Long have I waited. And now, you're coming together.
That's an excerpt from the movie Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. So there's a lot of nostalgia built into that franchise, not to mention all the other franchises that are building on their own nostalgia. Why, in the case of something like Star Wars, are some of the chapters so good, do so well at tapping into the original, and some do so poorly? And that goes for the other franchises that, well, I often have a checkered track record when it comes to trying to recapture the magic of the original material. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about two kinds of nostalgia-driven entertainment, Pastor Ted Geese. He has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, and he teaches a course for Concordia Lutheran Theological Seminary in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, titled A Lutheran Approach to Art, Media, and Film. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
What is nostalgia-driven entertainment again?
Well, I mean, I think people run into this mostly when they find some TV show from the past or some movie from the past that gets, sometimes they use the term like rebooted or reimagined or something, where they maybe it's a continuation of an older show, something like that. And it builds on like the nostalgia of the previous thing, right? So if somebody is a little kid, remembers watching it, and then they remember watching it as a kid, and now they're an adult, so now they've made a new version of it. Examples of this kind of thing would be Star Trek, of course, started back in the 1960s, 1966, and there's still Star Trek stuff now. Or Star Wars started back in 1979, and there's still Star Wars stuff now. So sometimes it's like a continuous thing, and other times there's like a break along the way, but it's banking on people's previous experience with something. So it's that nostalgic kick that they're that's in behind what's going on.
Talk a little, before we get into the kind of examples of this and the two kinds that there are, talk about how the entertainment industry has in many ways come to use this as a crutch. They are remaking and remaking and remaking sometimes the same movie with slight twists. Then they're also kind of pressing the franchise, the remake franchises, to their very thinnest degree. I'm thinking about Star Wars.
They're kind of opportunists in different ways, obviously. Like, I don't know if you remember, a number of years ago there was a big writer's strike, and then that's when all of the quote-unquote reality TV started up, like in the big kind of the way that it's kind of turned into what it is now. Before that, you didn't really have that. It was more, things were more scripted. Yeah, there was like talk shows and things like that that were less scripted. But the idea of having these reality TV shows came as a response to not having all of your writers and different people you normally would have had. So they just kind of, they get into a groove. They find the shortest distance between, you know, themselves and creating content in a effective way, and they go for it. So right now we're actually experiencing some of that too, because with the lockdowns and stuff, quarantines that people are going through during this COVID-19 business, like there are actors and actresses and people who are doing online things, or they're doing their parts from home. It's kind of a peculiar thing, or they're kind of tooling the idea of having shows. They're like reality shows, but they're even lower quality than the reality shows. So for instance, you know, like I think Jimmy Kimmel starts off and he's got like allegedly little pictures drawn by his kids that get thrown up at the front of the, because I guess they're slave labor at home. I don't know. But they, you know, like they'll include stuff that's like really not high quality because of course they're at home. And Amy Schumer's got a cooking thing with her husband. And like, this is the result of the situation that we're in. So, you know, all of this nostalgia driven stuff was also, you know, when a certain age group or a demographic, like when the baby boomers hit a certain age and they're the ones with a big chunk of the disposable income, then they start to tool things towards them and the things that they would find nostalgic, you know. And the Gen Xers are just hitting this kind of point where now they're kind of going back to things from the 90s or the late 80s, the 90s, because that's the stuff that's going to be nostalgic for them. So there's this, they're always kind of looking for who's got the disposable income, how they can work on bringing some sort of product to them that they could then get some money out of. This is kind of part of how they end up doing things. So they're looking at the what's going on and how best they can produce a product that will free you of your money and, in theory, entertain you.
So that's more or less the second kind of nostalgia entertainment, which is, you say it's parasitic in a lot of ways. But there is, and here are some examples would be helpful, there is a kind of nostalgia entertainment that doesn't just kind of bleed the life out of the original, but builds on it. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this stuff for a while, and I started putting some notes together, and I haven't published anything, or there's no written article out anywhere, but I've been thinking about this. So I kind of have two different ways of looking at this. So the first one, the one that you're kind of getting at right now, is I'll just read what I've got written for this idea. So basically, it's actual creative investigation of the original material. Changes made improve on the original and allow for more character development and greater drama. Often uses fan service in a integrated way that doesn't feel cheap, but actually expands where the original left off. The project is the end in and of itself, not a means to an end. The project gains a following because it is honest with its fans and delivers a quality product without insulting the fan base. So that would be one kind of nostalgia. And I think that the key for this kind of nostalgia is that the people making it themselves love the original material and have an understanding of how it works, basically. And they want to see maybe something was somewhat substandard originally, but then, or as the years went by, things, it kind of was, it didn't hold up as well, and they wanted to come and bring something really wonderful to it. So an example of that would be like Tron from 1982, which was super innovative at the time. And it was there was a bit of an Oscar problem with that movie, a bit of a controversy, because they thought that using computers to make imagery was cheating. Like that was a movie where they couldn't win certain awards because they cheated by using the computer. Of course, now everything's changed. But then in 2010, there was this film, Tron Legacy, which really was an extension of that original and very high quality, and people really enjoyed it. The fans really enjoyed it. It wasn't as commercially successful as they had hoped, so there's not like dozens of these movies. But it's an example of one where they took something that they loved and they made it into something even better as they were able to later on.
The Star Trek franchise has kind of a checkered track record when it comes to being either the first kind of nostalgia or the second, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, you remember this thing probably. A lot of the listeners might remember this, where for a while there, they used to say that the even-numbered films were the better ones and the odd-numbered films were the bad ones. So if you wanted to kind of look at it like that. But yeah, it's a little more checkered. So there are times where this nostalgia works really well. For instance, like the original TV show, you had the episode with the character of Khan. Now, there was The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II from 1982. that's one where they went back and they actually got the original actor, Carl Montalban, who played Khan, and they brought him in, or Ricardo Montalban. They brought him in and they looked at it as like, these guys are older now, and what, how does that impact their relationship with each other, and what would it be like if these characters ran into each other again, and the rest of it. And that was really good. Now, interestingly, we've talked about the second of the reboot Star Trek films, Star Trek Into Darkness, I think it was called. And that's, again, one where they tell the story of Khan, but now in like an alternate universe. And that was not as good. So that was one where they wanted to use the hook of the character of Khan because of the 1982 film and because of the original show, but it didn't work as well. And we can talk about reasons for all of that stuff later. But essentially, you know, like that's a case where it kind of fell apart. But of course, that first rebooted Star Trek one with Chris Pine and that one, Star Trek from 2009, actually was pretty good. So, it, you know, sometimes these are a bit of a mixed bag, and it really depends on the combination of who's working on it and what their end goals are. And again, that gets into the idea that, are you making something because it just needs to be a good thing, or, you know, are you making it to please the producers? And sometimes these both happen, but sometimes the one can get in the way of the other.
I think that 2009 reboot worked for a couple reasons. In terms of nostalgia, it was technically a prequel, albeit in an alternate universe.
Right.
Its casting was brilliant. I could not imagine trying to step into a role like James T. Kirk or Mr. Spock as a young actor, but the people who did that did it, and did it just so convincingly. It was really entertaining to watch. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. And this is where it kind of, because it was this alternate universe, this is where you can use that actually in a good way. And they managed to, you know, like Zachary Quinto plays Spock, and then they were able to pull in Zoe Saldana to play Uhura, and they've created a relationship there with Uhura and Spock, which wasn't part of the original TV series or the other films. But that kind of created this interesting dynamic within the story, which actually teased out more things about the characters and built up on where the story could go in a way that was really great. And the inclusion of like Bruce Greenwood as Pike in that was done so well. He was the father figure that Kirk needed and all the rest of it. And they were able to kind of go somewhere interesting with it. Unfortunately, as it progressed, these movies kind of started to lose their way. And it, because of some other things that we can, you know, talk about in a bit.
You cite as another example of the better kind of nostalgia entertainment, the Rocky franchise.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting one. Like, Rocky is one of those, you know, Sylvester Stallone was involved right from the get-go. It was kind of his baby, right, this project. And, it gets a little goofy at times along the way. But the first ones were very, very solid films and, like, Oscar contenders and everything. Then they had Sylvester Stallone kind of had, like, gone back to some of these characters. So in 2006, there was this film, Rocky Balboa, which was actually a really good movie, and that kind of dealt with him being kind of an older guy now, and how's he dealing with all of this stuff being, you know, having been a boxer and the rest of it. And then he kind of slides into the Burgess Meredith type character when you get to the film Creed from 2015, and then there was the subsequent follow-up to that in 2018, and we talked about that second one as well. That way, like, they're good movies on their own, but they link nicely into the original films, and they have character of Rocky, played by Sylvester Stallone, in such a good way that links it back to the originals, and that's where it honors the past, but it's building on it and making something people can enjoy.
We're talking about two kinds of nostalgia-driven entertainment. Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. We'll talk about the Star Wars franchise and whether or not George Lucas, who started it all out, helps or hurts the nostalgia. We'll be right back.
In sickness and in health, in these days of coronavirus panic, people are learning how difficult keeping this vow can be. The May issue of the Lutheran Witness looks at the wedding day. How does the couple plan their wedding with their pastor in a way that points to Christ, the only one by whom and through whom they can keep these impossible wedding vows? Read all about how Christ keeps his church in sickness and in health in the Lutheran Witness. Subscribe at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about two kinds of nostalgia-driven entertainment with Pastor Ted Geese. He teaches a course for Concordia Lutheran Theological Seminary in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, titled A Lutheran Approach to Art, Media, and Film. Let's talk a little bit about the nostalgia of the Star Wars franchise. I've referred to George Lucas as the Philip Melanchthon of filmmakers because the longer you let him work on his own stuff, the more he kind of ruins it. Does that help explain why in some of the places where he did continue to amend things, even among the franchise's most ardent fans are also its most ardent critics?
Well, I kind of remember reading somewhere about him going through a divorce and getting into a relationship with Linda Ronstadt and then her breaking his heart. And after that, he just kind of shifted his focus and wanted to focus on making things that were more like little kid oriented. I mean, that was always a part of it. So like the original Star Wars films, of course, the toy line and all of these other things were part of it. And that was a big part of his involvement in it because he got rights to all of that stuff. But between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, all of a sudden the shift went to more to like kid-oriented stuff. And then there were cartoons and there were other things. But by the time he got to his prequel films, characters like Jar Jar Binks were in there because they were really oriented towards young children. Those young children are now millennials, like they're grown up, and they actually have a pretty, like, they like Ahmed Best, the guy who played Jar Jar Binks. They have very nostalgic, warm feelings towards him, and he's actually involved in some sort of podcast talking about Star Wars-related stuff. Interestingly, like, George Lucas is coming through kind of a bit of a renaissance in a way because, you know, he'd handed the keys to the kingdom over to Kathleen Kennedy, and that's kind of caught, you know, is very mixed and divided the whole Star Wars fandom into people who like these new films and people who really don't like them, people who are kind of in the meh category of all of it. But then with something like The Mandalorian, he's kind of in the background. Like he's still somebody who's being contacted and he's got some involvement. And I think people are starting to think, you know, like he was a lot more solid on a bunch of things than people thought he was. And there was all of these like Clone Wars cartoons, like the digital cartoons and things like that, the computer animated ones. There's some involvement with him, but he's just not the main guy anymore. But I think that like the ones who have this real love for Star Wars, they really want to access him, like Dave Filoni and people like that are involved with things like The Mandalorian. So there's a little bit of George Lucas still kicking around in the midst of all of this, and maybe it's the right amount, I don't know, but the feature films are the ones where things really started to go in a different kind of direction.
I cannot stand the main actor in the Mission Impossible franchise, but I love the movies. I just think that Tom Cruise is not a great actor, and he missed his calling as a stuntman. That's what he really wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like any of his movies except for Purple Sky and the Mission Impossible franchise. But then again, I grew up watching the original Mission Impossible. Why does that work so well?
Yeah, he's an interesting character. Apparently, he's going to be shot into space. And I'm kind of wondering if he can just stay there. I don't know. There's the new news in the last couple of days is that he's going to be shooting a film with NASA on the International Space Station. So, and again, it's like we've talked about Tom Cruise and we've talked about his Scientology and we've talked about his kind of like uber works righteousness kind of I'm doing it kind of, you know, fulfillment of Scientology where he's like there. He's almost going through some sort of like apotheosis in front of our very eyes. My wife and I were talking about this the other night, thinking about, like, I was thinking about our interview for today, and I was thinking about all of this, and the news story about him came up. And I just kind of think to myself that all of Scientology, their eggs are in his basket in a lot of ways. And they've got, like, you know, when people go bowling, they'd have, like, the bumpers on the sides for, like, little kids and stuff, so the ball doesn't go in the gutter. This is what his life is like. He's got all of these people with these bumpers up on either side of everything, and he's being funneled towards this greatness like some sort of crazy billboard, right? And I don't know when it's all going to come crashing down. I don't know how, like, when he's going to hit some sort of zenith where there's nowhere else to go. Like, going to space to shoot a movie is insane. But the thing about these movies, these Mission Impossible films, is he keeps raising the ante and he keeps going for the more complicated, the more difficult thing. And somehow he's able to achieve these things. He could die while making a movie. I mean, like there was the one scene in the last one of those films where he jumped across, you know, from one building to another building and broke his ankle, you know, as he was grappling onto the building that he was jumping towards. Well, I mean, he could have fallen off of that. Like, it's really actually kind of crazy. But the thing is you remember the original TV show and the first of those Mission Impossible films with him in it, with Tom Cruise in it from like 1996, it was very formulaically kind of close to the TV show. Like, it fit that TV show. Since then, it's kind of continued to develop and morph and kind of build into its own thing. But again, it's because the people who are involved in it love doing it. They love kind of making these moments, these big grandiose moments, and the whole spy versus spy kind of stuff. And they just keep improving the quality of the films. I mean, this last one was a little convoluted, but they've really actually been quite good.
And they know exactly when to score the original music in the action. That original music is the nostalgia of these films. And if they left that out of the action, I probably wouldn't like him as much.
No, I mean, you would actually be pretty disappointed. If you went to, like, if there's going to be another one and you go to it and they're like, yeah, we ditched that. That was just old fashioned. The new generation doesn't care about that. You would be pretty upset. Like, you'd be like, I was duped, right? That's the way you'd feel.
So let's talk about a few examples of nostalgia gone wrong.
Yeah, so I'll give you kind of the counterpoint kind of definition here. So this would be the counterpoint. So a parasitic approach to the original material. The franchise becomes a vehicle for advancing social agendas and identity politics. And or the end goal is to make money over and above fidelity to the original material. Sometimes the creative team either fails to understand the material that they are working with, or they struggle to deliver on their passion for the original material because of studio interference. The project becomes a means to an end, but not the end in and of itself. It exploits a fan base, pushing their luck to see just how far they can push things and still achieve their goals, which are often contradictory to that of the original fan base. So that would be kind of another way, like that's the other way that nostalgia gets done.
Let's start with just the worst example of this. What would that be for you?
Well, I don't know about the absolute worst, but a really bad one would be the original Ghostbusters films and then the 2016 Ghostbuster film that came out where they did a gender swap on all of like the main characters. That one was one where you can have strong female characters. And the other day we talked about Lost in Space as an example. So Lost in Space, the mother in the original TV show wasn't the same as the Maureen Robinson you get in this new TV show that's on Netflix. And the new one is she's got some serious flaws, but she's also very heroic. And even though there's a lot of dumb things that happen left, right, and center, they end up having opportunities to be heroic. And she's kind of taking the lead on that in the first season. But by the time you get to the second season, the husband, he actually has a lot of really heroic and great moments, and his character develops. And they're kind of like we were talking about, going from a low ebb to up into like being quite a high-functioning family, even though everything crazy is going on around them. Lost in Space would be something would fit into that first category of nostalgia done well. And the reason I bring that up is because like I like having strong female characters that are able to do heroic things or are able to be great characters in and of themselves. But I don't think that that has to be done by dragging down the men characters. Like, you don't solve the one problem by creating a new problem. So when it comes to Ghostbusters, the one thing that was kind of crazy about it is they took Annie Potts from the original, who was the kind of administrator of the Ghostbusters office that made sure that they knew about where they were going to bust ghosts. And they took that character and they put in, and she was always kind of acerbic and, you know, I wouldn't really categorize her as a sex symbol, let's say. But what they did in the new one is they took that character and they made it Chris Hemsworth. So Thor is in that character. And then they make a bunch of dumb blonde jokes. So the guys have all been turned into ladies. And then you've got the woman secretaries turned into, or administrators turned into this guy. But then they're doing all of these dumb blonde jokes and making all of these stupid jokes about him. So I'm thinking to myself, you don't fight sexism with sexism. You're not going to achieve your goals that way. So amongst all of the other things that were complicated with that, and like, you know, Bill Murray didn't want to be involved in a Ghostbusters project, so they ended up making this particular Ghostbusters film. It wasn't kind to the original material, and it seemed to have it was hectoring everybody into a, you know, like, look at us, we're doing it right, etc. We're on the right side of history when it comes to this. But not just by like actually creating good, strong, powerful, interesting, great female characters, but by also like downplaying or making, you know, side comments that were, you know, unkind to the men characters. So this is where it just like that kind of thing just doesn't work at all. Interestingly, there is going to be a new Ghostbusters film that has a bunch of the original cast in it, and then that Wolfhart kid from Stranger Things is also going to be in it. So that's supposed to be coming out sometime soon. Well, might have been coming out this summer, but of course things aren't coming out the way they used to be coming out with all the theaters closed down. But like that was, I don't know if you saw that movie or not, but it kind of fits into that kind of idea where identity politics kind of and social agendas really hijack the whole thing.
Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. We're talking about two kinds of nostalgia-driven entertainment. We'll talk about what happened to the latest attempts to keep the Star Wars nostalgia going next. Dressing up to be there too, and we're gonna have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies, who cares what picture you see?
Despair says nobody cares, and that's not true.
Dr. Christian Kincaid, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort.
And despair says there's no hope for me. And that's not true. To despair is not of God.
Learn more about Living with Grief at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we're going to continue our romp through Romans. God's righteousness upheld, no one righteous. Righteousness with God given. Justification upholds the law, and Abraham justified by faith. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. We're talking about two kinds of nostalgia-driven entertainment. So in the vein of kind of nostalgia gone wrong, what do you think happened to the latest or some of the latest attempts to keep the Star Wars nostalgia going?
Well, it seems like Star Wars in the feature films kind of lost its way. So there's this term that gets used, and there's some debate. Some people don't think that this is the case, and some people do think that it's the case. But there's this term that gets used called Mary Sue. So a Mary Sue is a writer surrogate or an audience surrogate where it's more of a fantasy kind of thing, where the Mary Sue character is usually a woman character who does everything right all the time and nothing, like she gets through everything. There's no consequences. She's just overpowerful kind of a thing. So the character of Rey is sometimes described as a Mary Sue. And I think I've even heard people talk about men in this way, and maybe Tom Cruise would fit into the character of a Jerry Sue, you know, where everything just kind of goes his way and nothing goes against him, or there's no real trouble that he has to overcome. Everything is kind of too easy. So in like video games, they call this the God mode, where you just like, you can just power through the whole entire game without, you know, any, you know, breaking a sweat exactly or at all. So that's kind of part of the problem with it, because it short circuits what you would have had in the original film. I mean, the idea that Luke Skywalker is on this kind of hero's journey, he doesn't get through it unscathed. You know, like he loses a hand, like his father cuts his hand off, and, you know, he has failures. He makes mistakes and has setbacks. That's not what you find in these films. And again, this kind of, there's another thing that's going on too, is that, you know, you get in The Last Jedi this kind of like demasculinization of characters, or humiliation of male characters. And it's intended to make the female characters seem more, to have a bigger role or something. But that's just not the way to do it. It's not egalitarian. And it's not showing respect in any kind of way to men. And it actually doesn't show respect to women either. So the character of Poe Dameron in The Last Jedi, he's like completely cut down at every turn. And he's written to be a hothead who needs to learn a lesson. But then by the last film, The Rise of Skywalker, then he's supposed to be going to be the guy who's going to lead everything in the end. But none of it really lands really well, because it seems like we're being quote-unquote taught a lesson instead of learning a lesson, if that makes any sense.
Here's a franchise kind of finally here that I am totally unfamiliar with. I am a Doctor Who novice. I have a very vague sense of what this premise is. He's a time-traveling alien of some kind, and they don't seem to care too much who they cast in the various incarnations of him. That's all I know about it. So why does Doctor Who, the original franchise that was really decades long, and the latest reboot of Doctor Who not work in terms of nostalgia for you, Ted?
Well, okay, so usually the way this goes for people is the first Doctor they get introduced to is like, quote-unquote, their Doctor. That's the Doctor that's the real Doctor Who. So for me, it was Tom Baker. I was a young kid, and I think it was like, I don't know, after soccer practice or something, I went to a friend's house and we watched it on PBS, because that's how we got it up here in Canada. And that was the Doctor for me. So I would see the other ones along the way, because every 3 or 4 years, they would get a new actor to play the character of the Doctor. He would regenerate it started back in 1963. So from 1963 to 1989, they had it on TV in Britain on BBC every year from 1963 to 1989. Then there was a break, and then Fox in the United States wanted to kind of like reboot it all. So they got Paul McGann to play the Doctor. It was supposed to set the whole thing up, but it totally fell flat. So there was one episode of that, kind of like a miniseries, TV movie kind of thing in 1996. And then when you hit 2005, that's when Eccleston is brought in. And then after that, David Tennant. And that's where it kind of picks up again. And that had nostalgic factor. And Doctor Who kind of continually worked the nostalgia angle, because each time they got a new Doctor to play the part, then that Doctor would come across some of the same aliens that the previous Doctor had to. And the whole thing is always averting some sort of world catastrophe. And he's kind of the personal protector of Earth. So when alien invasions come, he's the one who figures out how to stop the alien invasion, etc. And that happens over and over again. So each Doctor might have things where they have to deal with the Cybermen or the Daleks or these different kinds of aliens. So when it kind of got going again in 2005, you know, there were these great nostalgic moments, and they were able, though, to build on everything and put it in the right direction. But then things started to kind of get a little off kilter. And the thing about Doctor Who is that occasionally it would definitely wade into like the social politics of the day, let's say, but it started to get really a little more on the nose, a little kind of more blunt. And they had this Peter Capaldi, who became the actor who was playing the Doctor. And that's really where it started to kind of go off in a different direction, I found. So I kind of hacked it through those. And then I went through the one season of it where this Jodie Whittaker then now is playing the Doctor. And the thing that I guess is the most aggravating about like Doctor Who as an example is that like when this is like, this is fantasy, right? This is all sci-fi fantasy stuff. And this is actually the same for Star Wars. It's actually the same for Star Trek, or it would be for Harry Potter or any of these kinds of things. What they do is they do something called world building. So they actually like make a set of rules that make sense inside that story. And they follow those rules. And they ask the audience to buy into those rules. And then they deliver on those rules over and over and over again, right? So this once parasitical kind of like approach to nostalgia comes up, and they just want to use it, like they're taking the goodwill of the fans, hoping that they're going to get the financial benefit from the goodwill of the fans. And they take it, but they want to run off in a direction that breaks all of those rules because of, I guess, social agendas or identity politics, as an example. That's when the audience, the fan base, can start to feel betrayed. Sometimes people may go, okay, well, whatever, it's all just fantasy anyways. And they'll say, fine, I'll go with you on this journey in this different direction. But when you have had 12 regenerations of this Doctor, and you've clearly set up the rule that he's a man and that like he's male and he keeps regenerating as a male, and there are women time doctors or whatever, all of the rest of it, when they suddenly do a gender swap and then they start doing all of this stuff about how terrible men are, it starts to kind of go like, why did you do that? They took like this arch nemesis of the Doctor along the way and then swapped it into a woman actress playing the part. And that happened with Peter Capaldi during his run. But they didn't have to do that. Doctor Who already had female villains in the past. So this is just an example where it's like they're hoping the old audience just kind of carries along with them. And maybe they want to expand to a new audience. And they're trying to get this kind of quote unquote woke culture, bunch of people to jump on board. But this is like oil and water. And often these things don't mix well together. And it causes massive conflict. As viewers, you just kind of get to the point where it's like, are you just going to carry on because of your nostalgic feelings? You know, oh, they've played the music in the right spot, so I'm getting my nostalgic moment. Or do you actually say, all right, this isn't the thing that it used to be. now I'm going to just say goodbye to it and move on.
Finally, Ted, what I'm kind of waiting for as a erstwhile movie fan is the non-nostalgic moment. And maybe it's just the aha experience or something new, because we're awash in all of this nostalgia that often fails. And I'm referring here to maybe kind of the moment when I sat in the theater and watched the original Matrix for the first time.
Right.
And I said, here's something I have never seen before. Here are directors and filmmakers. I want to watch these guys' movie. I know this is going to be a franchise. And it was something completely and utterly different. Are we ever going to get that again?
Well, I think so. I mean, like, we'll put it this way. We've talked about this a little bit before, like quite a while ago, but like, for instance, there was a stretch along the way where you had like all of these like Western movies and TV shows and things like that. And then it was like there was a bubble, like all of the sci-fi movies and the Westerns and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the 60s, there was like a bubble and it like popped. And like the 1970s started to turn into like more gritty, like tougher things. So all of a sudden you get like movies like Rocky are in there, or the Godfather films start off in there, or things like The Shining or whatever. There's material and stuff that shows up that people are like, this is different. This is not the same as before. And what we're going to do here, like I'm sure is what's going to happen, is they're going to, like the parasitic approach to nostalgia, they're going to run that tank until it's empty. They're going to go and do that, not changing the oil until the engine seizes up on that thing. And when that happens, the bubble bursts and pops, and then they're going to have to do something completely different. So I feel like we've been sitting on this nostalgia bubble. You know, like when they start monkeying around too much with the internal rules of something like the Marvel Universe, and people start to get the stench of like a lot of identity politics and stuff being injected into it, they're going to start to feel like, well, I just don't want to watch that anymore. And if their money goes south, then they're going to try to find different ways to approach this. So I think that, you know, like there's going to be directors that are going to come along. Like I remember some of the first Wes Anderson films I saw, I was like, wow, this is just amazing. So every once in a while, somebody's going to come along with a different way of doing things, or with a different voice as a filmmaker, or as a, you know, at this point, you know, like we're watching a lot of things on Netflix and different streaming services. But, you know, like that's the only way out of this. And as an opportunity to get the thing that you're talking about, I think that a lot of people who watch movies are looking for that. And, you know, especially in particular genres, like if you watch a lot of horror films, let's say, or you watch a lot of science fiction films, or whatever the case might be, you start to kind of go, okay, well, I want the thing that's going to be exciting and different. And the Christian who watches all of this stuff just needs to ask themselves, like, you know, do I want to keep watching this thing, whatever it is, even if I had like some sort of really enjoyable experience in the past? Like, it's okay to eventually just go, listen, this isn't for me anymore, and to back away from the table. Like, you can do that. You're free to. This is your free time, and this is supposed to be entertaining. It's not supposed to be indoctrination, let's say.
Pastor Ted Geese has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. He teaches a course for Concordia Lutheran Theological Seminary in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, titled The Lutheran Approach to Art, Media, and Film. You'll find a link to his movie reviews on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Ted, thanks.
Thank you.
Issues Etc. has been brought to you in part today by Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where they form servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess at ctsfw.edu. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll be talking with Anne Schlafly-Corey about the Netflix series Mrs. America. We'll discuss the communion liturgy with Pastor Peter Bender, and we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. our mailing address, issues, etc. P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.